Welcome to the Inspirational Insights, Insights to Action podcast. My name is Donna Jones. I'm your host, and I am very excited to have Christian Feinberg of Roche, Sweden with me today, or with us today, should I say, to talk about the transformation that they went through from hierarchy to and command and control to shared leadership and network decision-making. Christian, perhaps I'll just jump right in and ask you to give a little bit of an overview of Roche, because there's a lot of people listening that won't have a clue who you are, yeah. Who the company is. I will say that the company started in 1896. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, there's some, you know, adaptive DNA built into the way of thinking there. Otherwise, that company would not be around by now. So I'll hand it over to you, Christian.
Yeah, so thank you much for having me. I really look forward to the discussion today and hope I will bring some valuable insights or ideas that you can take back. So first of all, I'm Christian. I've been part of Roche for about 12 years. I'm currently the transformational lead in Sweden and also a coach, not by title, but more by profession, meaning I'm leading, I would say, half of the organization in Sweden. We have an oncology-based organization and non-oncology. I'm leading non-oncology. So that means that Roche is a pharmaceutical company. It's a massive pharmaceutical company. We have over 100,000 employees across the whole globe. We are multinational. We have operations in every corner of the globe. And we are focusing on innovative solutions for patients, meaning that we don't do copycats, we don't do what others do. We try to be an innovative company where we bring additional value through our medicines and solutions. And that includes both pharmaceuticals and diagnostic tools. I'm representing the pharma side. We also have a diagnostic side here in Sweden and across the globe. That's obviously part also of this transformations that we've done, but my accountability is around pharma. For Roche, in many ways, there is a strong will to make difference. You know, our kind of tagline is we do what patients need next. I mean, we always have this constant drive to see improvements. And for me, obviously, being part of this is really encouraging to see what difference you can make. And 12 years ago, we were a different company. These days we are. And as you said, being here for so many years, there's been a constant evolution over the organization. And I would say on the scale that we have, to still have this kind of familiarity, meaning that you have a local kind of adaptation and openness to see how the world operates and to adapt to that, is just phenomenal. I'm so proud of the company. I'm so proud to be part of this. And I'm sure that, you know, if you ask a normal colleague in Roche, they are very well engaged and believe in the vision and the future of this company.
Now, were they well engaged 12 years ago?
I would say back then we were really successful. I think we still are very successful. So I think that was the starting trend where monoclonal antibodies really entered the and monoclonal antibodies are used for severe diseases as cancer, rheumatitis, those kind of, you know, difficult diseases. That was a new era by then. So I think people were engaged about that. But we were also very much operated in a hierarchical way. There was, you know, control as a foundation. We are Swiss, so maybe that sounds a bit like, you know, the German style. There were directions from above sending down. And then I think people were excited about the kind of innovation, but also I think in many ways we're feeling that, you know, I can do more than this. I'm control. My middle manager says, tell me what to do. That manager tells that person what to do. Looking back, you know, because I joined from another pharmaceutical company, I felt that, you know, people like what they do, but they also felt a bit, you know, suboptimally used. I would say that's the world I find. I think there were many capacities that was not used in the organization by then. And I think that's something we have tried to address, not only in the last couple of years, but along the last, I would say, decade.
At some point, the decision must have been made to engaging in a transformation. Do we tweak it or do we transform it? And if we look at the difference, the nuance is going to be made of how the whole design of the company. What was that process?
It's a great question. If I look back, I think the natural way would be to tweak, because that's easier. Let's fix a few things and then we'll be great again. Or let's remove this and see what happens. But I think we all felt when we started this transformation that there is so much more we can do. There is so much happening in the world that we just doing a tweak won't make it. And I think, again, it's the whole healthcare sector, the whole humanity, I think, has moved on to this information fully available everywhere. There is innovation happening at a speed that we, you know, couldn't even imagine 10 years ago. I think COVID is a great example of another, you know, phenomenal that where collaborations happens across pharmaceutical companies and healthcare industries. And obviously we didn't know that when we started the transmission, but I think there's so many signs out there that needs more than a tweak. And I think for me and for the whole organization, that was a finding that we said, let's see where we can go by really changing, preferably our culture, because I think that's the main part that we have worked on, but in some ways also the structure of the company. And I think it's hard to do transformations and it's hard to do, you know, cultural changes, but it was necessary. Again, if you talk to a colleague in the organization, they would say that was necessary to happen. And then again, it looks differently in different parts of the organization, but I would say every affiliate, as we say, or every country that works with our products has seen a need of a shift. And obviously also our global leaders have seen that, but it's been very much up to each affiliate, to each country to define how could that look like. And I think that's another way of, on another thing that I'm really proud of, that we have been able to design our journey ourselves. Obviously there's been some guiding principles or guardrails from the global organization, but I would say 95% of the initiatives that we've done in Sweden is defined by us in Sweden to meet our demands, to meet our external environment, to meet the challenges and opportunities that we have in our daily practice. For me, to be able to have that impact, to be able to have that accountability to tailor your journey is, I'm sure there are other companies that, you know, could allow for it, but I think in the scale that we have in you know, in the value that we bring, you know, turnover is massive here and every affiliate has a big accountability. I'm just amazed and proud that we got that accountability on a local level.
So now you've alluded to two things that I think are really critical. One of them is the vision. You know, yeah. Where are we going collectively as an organization of 100,000? And then the role of guiding principles. I'm just working on something around principles. So I'm excited to hear you say that. So let's talk about that, please.
Yeah.
What is the vision that unified everyone's focus worldwide toward accomplishing something? And how is that shared? And then if you will, talk about the guiding principles.
Yeah, so the common vision for the whole organization is to deliver 3 to 5 times more medical innovation to half the cost of society. We want to have a much more value-driven organization, meaning that we want to provide a higher set of innovations, and we want to do that at a much less cost, meaning that we need to find ways of working differently. We need to find ways of saying, what do we don't need to do that we do today? What do we actually do with the limited resources that we have to be able to pull that through? And I think for me, that's been a really strong kind of guiding principle, a North Star that everyone is working against. And within that is also, you know, this kind of doing now what patients need next, meaning always find this ambition of doing better. How can we improve? Where can we find ways of improving? And for me, and I think for all our colleagues, this is really close to our heart. And I think that's what you need with a vision. It needs to feel, is this right? Yeah, this is right. This is what our society and healthcare will need. You know, pharmaceutical industry has a bad reputation because we are charging a lot for medical innovations and people need to pay for it and governments need to pay for it. So we have this kind of wish, we can't just ask for more and more and more and doing, you know, innovation that is, you know, just slightly better. We need to find really big improvements and we need to make it in a very costly, effective way so people can get access to those. And I think that is a very sustainable and very, I think, engaging vision. And that's how we started. And based on that saying, obviously we then need to find how can we transform ourselves to be able to make it happen. And then we come to the principles. And I think there we had the differences. I think every affiliate was, you know, approaching, this is what we're aiming for, you know, translate that to your local environment. And that was, you know, the principle where we got really strong in Sweden was that we want to allow our every person in the organization to be the best self. That was more or less the starting point. How can we allow our people to really deliver and engage what they are able to do? And for us, that was looking into every kind of corner, saying, what barriers, what limitations have we put on our organization or people that we can actually remove? And secondly, obviously on the other side, how can we support and enable them to actually use all the capabilities? And based on those, we then tailored 3 key balances that we wanted to correct. Because when we looked into organization in Sweden, it was a very internal focused organization. We were coming from many years of success. Business was almost running by itself. So we said, that's not being our best self. That's not delivering 3 to 5 times more innovation by sitting in meetings and discussing what the customers needs. We need to tweak that to saying, if we go from 70% internal to 30% external, could that be, you know, an opposite shift? 70% external, 30% internal. So that was the first kind of key balance that we wanted to correct from internal to external. I think that's very well aligned to what agile organizations do. You know, you listen to your customers and they, together with you, work on how you can improve. The second thing that was a key principle was this process structure versus speed. So we had, many a success, created a lot of controlling processes, a lot of unnecessary shit, sorry to say, that we were dealing with every day. We just made a stop saying, let's look at this. What are we doing? If you look on a week, I probably spent 50, 60% of my time asking others to present what they were doing. We said, that can't be the role of a manager. And then, you know, we went through some other roles and suddenly just realized there's so many processes that we have just created because people want to know. And then we took a conscious decision that there still will be need of some processes, with there's laws and regulations that we need to follow. Obviously, we should keep that clinical trial. You can't just, you know, do as you want with clinical trials. That needs to be a protocol. Obviously, we need to follow. But in many ways, we can, you know, release some of the processes and get speed. Speed is a competitive advantage. We want to be quick. We want to learn quick. And if we see something that doesn't work, obviously, we'll be quick to fix that. So that was the second, speed versus structure and process. And then you have another key feature of organization, and I think many organizations see themselves, is the perfection. So we overdid the presentations internally. We spent months to prepare for internal reviews. We were sending external activities or allowing external activities that the customer said, this is too much. We only wanted this, and you, now you come with all of this. So then we said, another balance that we need to fix is this kind of 80-20 mentality, meaning good enough versus perfection. Again, in some areas, we need perfection. So maybe again, the 70 perfection, 30 just, you know, good enough needs to shift to 70% good enough, 30% perfection. So those were the key 3 balances. First of all, people should be the best self. We should allow for that. Anything we can do to make that happen should happen. And secondly, these 3 key balances were the guiding principles: external focus, speed or just do it, and obviously then the 80-20 or the good enough principles. Those were the starting point of how we kicked off our change. And I think if I look back, it's just come to us. You know, this was just disgusting happening. What do we see? You know, obviously we had a lot of discussions internally with people, also some external discussions. When I do my retrospective, it was so clear. People said, yeah, this is right. This is exactly, you know, if I would summarize our company in, you know, this is where we have gone wrong. We got buy into that. And then, you know, the journey was on.
Wonderful. Well, okay. So now I'm excited about talking about dismantling the hierarchy, if you will. That is a term that comes up a number of times. We need to dismantle the hierarchy, which normally strikes fear into the heart of every manager. How did you go about that, the morphing or the change between, you know, hierarchical command and control into something that's more networked? And I think you had a change in structure as well. You removed layers. So tell us more about that.
Yeah. So again, the guiding star was this, you know, more value outside. Again, allow our people to be our best self. And when we said that to people, some said, yeah, I can be by myself. There is a layer between me and you and layer that is stopping me. And I go to my manager for guidance, etc. So we start to think a bit about that. And then the first initiative that we actually did to see if we can do differently was an initiative that we call Pick Your Coach. And it's not coach by default that you're a train coach, but we allowed all of our people. And this was an experiment. We allowed everyone in organizations to pick a person outside the function and role as a coach to just see what that would boost. And the kind of selling point was this: everyone should be able to work with people that you get inspired from, etc. So that was the starting point. And then in those discussions, a lot of people brought back, saying, why couldn't I select my manager? Why couldn't the next step be pick my manager? And then we said, oh, and we were, you know, the transformational leads, myself and a colleague of mine, were a bit shocked about that because we hadn't, you know, that was not the plan that we thought of. But it still stuck to us. And then when our people all said, the structure that we have is holding us back. You know, you said again, we should be allowing to be our best self. The structure we have is not promoting that because we are sitting in silos. We have leaders that is there to control or to deliver what they have as accountability. That needs to stop. And then again, okay, thank you for feedback. Let's start that process. So that was the kickoff of the restructuring of the operating model and the organization. And we had design teams working, you know, there was a selection of people included in that. And they were very clear when they come up with the prototype saying, if we will allow people to be the best self, that needs to be a full empowerment. We need to trust them. We need to guide them and help them, but we need to trust them and empower them to make it happen. Before that, we had the kind of colleagues, we have the middle managers, and we have the senior leadership team. And we were in Sweden with about 100 colleagues, 115 by then, and we had 21 managers. And then we asked the design team, saying, okay, could you see a model where how could it look differently? And the actually their suggestion, and it was a mix in the design team of managers and non-managers, was to say, let's just skip the middle managers. We don't need middle managers because they are just, you know, between the senior leaders and an organization. So, okay, that was, of course, a bit shocking when we saw that. Senior leaders by then were about 6, and we had 15 then middle managers. But it was very strong from design teams. And then what we did was that we tested this with the whole organization, proposed that this is what they see this could bring by removing this. And I would say I was really, really happily surprised that it wasn't not everyone, but obviously a big majority of people said, yeah, we don't need those. It's not that they have done anything wrong. They have been there to control and help and be part of, you know, defining the task of the people. But if you say empowerment, if you say best self, that's not needed. So that was the decision in that. And then we designed the organization to have a bigger span of control of the senior leaders. And today everyone in the organization is either in the enabling team, and we are, I think, 10 in that. I'm part of that. And then they have the rest. So everyone reports into the senior leaders. And we are only operating as we call it the VAC methodology. We are visionaries, we are architects, we are catalysts, and we are coaches. So I have no power to say this is what you need to do. I have no power to be the expert in the fields that I operate. I'm there to coach, support, enable my people to be the best self. Then I work in the management team or enablement team with other, you know, company-wide or international questions, but with my people, and I have about 10, 12 people now, I think, that reports to me. I'm only there to support them. I'm only there to help them again. And I say this 10 times now, to promote them to be what they can be. My job is to remove those barriers, sometimes open up new doors, sometimes saying, have you talked to these people? Or, you know, I see you're being angry here. Why? What is there behind this? To trigger those discussions, sometimes it's self-learning. Sometimes I coach them. Sometimes I open doors to a new world. Sometimes I find external resources that can help them to deliver what they can deliver. So it's almost 8 months. We did this kind of top-down. We was telling the teams what to do. we had design teams proposing, we implemented it. And now I think 8, 10 months later, this is working. Obviously, there's been people leaving the organization because they wanted to be controlling managers. But I would say the absolute majority of the mini managers is still with us. Some have become senior leaders, but most are now working as partners, meaning that they do really valuable work for organization without having the control and command accountability.
So it's widely known that the layer called senior management and leadership in most organizations is the bottleneck for all progress. Did you have any cases, and if so, how did you handle them, where you've got someone at the top who's addicted to control and just simply won't let go, won't sort of make the shift from controlling other people to controlling what shows up to, you know, controlling the response essentially to outside stuff? How did that get handled internally?
Obviously, there was those situations. What we did is that because I see many organizations, I help a number of other Roche companies to kick off that transformation, is that we were very keen to say this is not us telling the people to change. This is us changing, and then we guide our people. So I think the enabling team or management team in Sweden, they were involved from day one, and no one could escape from that. If someone said, "Oh, don't believe in it," sorry, you need to believe into this. And if you don't believe, that's okay. But then you won't be here in the future. So there were a few of those discussions. There were people saying, "Not for me." And then we had a really honest, open discussion. How can we support them to do something else? Some left for other affiliates. Some left the organization. We're not that massive if you look on Sweden. So for me, it is a key importance that the senior leaders is the role models. Otherwise, I don't think you can pull through. I think they will read the lie and then, you've gone down the drain. So for me, that was so important. We were lucky to have a general manager or senior leader that is a true believer into this. That's not the case everywhere in Roche, but she's been the role model for the transformation. She is managing us as leaders. She is outstanding, really, really showing us how to do it. She's doing this, every second of her working day and private life for sure as well. So it hasn't been that painful that I expected. There's been, as I said, a few discussions, some people leaving, but I would say the absolute majority again has seen the value of this and has seen that, by allowing people, by empowering people, you actually get the much, more positive and engaged community. I also had a lot. I was commercial director, had 35 people under my span of control. Now I have 10, but I would say by then I was controlling and not really, I didn't really like what I did. I was just to collect and push people to do the job. Now I'm again, back to people like me again. People see the value. I help them. They help me. It's just a cultural and collaborative change. Yeah, people love the hierarchy. People love the career. But again, this is another career. This is another step instead. And for me, I'd rather have a job that I really enjoy and an environment where people feel really that they are contributing, collaborative, supportive. So I think the price of span of control is totally worth it. I never regretted that this was the step that we all took. And obviously this was very open. People were allowed to have an offboarding package. We were also, I haven't said much about that, but we were allowing people to opt in or opt out because we presented our expectations. We presented this is what we need for organization and empowerment and trust and allowing people to do what they believe is best is a central part. That can't be, compromised on that. So if you believe that you can't deliver that, that's okay. But opt out is then probably the alternative. Or join that side. Being empowered means that you can do and select what you want to do. So we have both of those examples.
Now, I'm sure along the way you've picked up on really core skills that are, I would say, are more sensitive to complexity, more sensitive to the uncertainty and the ambiguity context that we are in today from the outside world, certainly. But that, of course, meets face-to-face with the inside world. What are the core skills that you feel came out of this experience that, it, you know, are ones that every single person, it doesn't matter what layer of power they're at or authority that they're at, needs to embody?
I love that question. I think a key element that people underestimate is the beginner's mind. I think that to be curious, to really say, yeah, I probably know what the answer will be here, but I'd rather ask the questions anyway. And that's externally, internally. For me, this is to kind of go out and be curious, you know, say, okay, if they have an answer that you expect, ask a follow-up question. Say, okay, you said that. Because I've learned that maybe, you know, I'm not really a theory guy, but what you know is probably 15% of the reality. That's 85% unknown out there. And if you feel you're an expert, you will only operate in those 15%. But I want us, all of us, to be this kind of, I wonder how this works. I wonder what they say if I ask the question. I wonder what if I call this person, what would be the reaction? To have that beginner's mind constantly with you is how I see as a key. And then secondly, I think a pragmatic approach. I think we are way too much of this, you know, it needs to be like this. So I think a pragmatic approach will always serve the purpose of learning. You know, if you say, okay, maybe I had another expectations here, but let's be pragmatic. Let's find something that you know, suits both of us. That's killing the ego, so to say, or leave the ego at home. That is necessary in the organization we have. And the third element is that we can't deliver any solution without including the external world. I think we have been operating for way too long, and we know what our customers need. And I would say today, if someone would come to me and say, oh, I have this idea, the first question I would ask is, who have you talked to externally about it? Who do you plan to work with? It's been so easy to say, I think they like this. I've heard this, but I think for me that's the starting point. So again, working, always including the external environment in the discussion, always being curious, and always having this. Okay, let's find a solution at least. You know, let's start somewhere. And I know Agile has this, you know, MVP, starting small, being, but I'd rather have, let's do something. You know, if it's small or big, doesn't matter, but just do something, because that will learn us something. Just to plan, just to maybe I wait for my customers to call me. That can't be how we want to operate. That's not speed. That's not, you know, being good enough. It should be, let's act and see what happens, and really have this kind of open mind. And we went to a lot of other companies, really taught us amazing stuff. We went to the CEGO where they set their own salary. We went to a company where they have like 300 employees reporting to one person. We went to Spotify saying, how do you really optimize incentives and rewards in an agile? I was just amazed how open they were, how inviting they were. And we had no clue what to expect. But if you go there, ask questions, you know, with a really open mind, you learn a lot. And I think that's how we want to operate also with our customers and with our peers across the world.
You mentioned, and I got all excited because sensing is critically important to how I read underlying dynamics in organizations and in any kind of transformation. I'm going to hone in on that one, obviously. How did you bring that forward? How did you cultivate it? How did you use the sensing capacity that you have internally?
I don't think memos or emails or town halls change an organization. So we said, we need to talk to individuals one by one or two by two, you know, that's how we want to sense how we are progressing. So that's how we did. We aligned with a couple of what we call transformation influencers. So there were people raising their hands saying, I love these ideas. What can I do to help? Say, oh, come along. You can be part of this. We had the same with the enabling team. Come along. But they couldn't choose because they said, you need to come along. And then we had a few others, external people helping us. And I would say, almost the first half of the journey was based on discussion by discussion, meeting up with people, sometimes invitations, sometimes by the coffee machine, sometimes, you know, when we heard something that people were a bit hesitant or a bit, you know, lost in translation, we went there saying, you know, love that you're lost in translation. That's great. How can we, what can we learn from this? How can we take you further? So I think that that is how we did it. And I think obviously there are different scales of companies, but I would recommend any organization saying, you know, it is these, you know, one-to-one, so the smaller discussion. It doesn't need to be ours. It's more like, can I get 10 minutes? You're a great person. I, you know, really trust your good intentions here. Tell me, you know, what do you like? What do you don't like? What don't you understand? What do you understand of this? And then collectively, you know, of course we did retrospectives. We did some pulse checking, but I think the key was these smaller informal discussions where people, I think in most cases, were very honest saying, a key part has been we did know that we're going to do a lot of mistakes or failures because we didn't really have a plan. Sorry to say that, but we had an idea. We were doing this experiment by experiment, step by step. And I think the whole sensing was key to get us right. These smaller informal discussions is obviously that takes some time, but I think we were very, very patient in a way that we said, if we rush through this, it won't be sustainable. Let's make it in a pace that the organization tolerates and finds attractive. We allowed for that. And then when we did something new, we again, you know, implemented it, did run it for some time, and then we went out. Some we met probably 15 times along the journey. Some we probably had 3 or 4 discussions with because they were either buying in or not buying in at all. But we really tried to care and listen in. I think that was, and that was internally, I would say, mostly.
I believe that that's the source of organizational intuition. I believe that's the that's where the nuances get picked up that the mind can't detect, you know, that helps the steering of where we go next. So now let's take it over to the consumer, to your customers. How did the relationship change from the beginning of the transformation to in the end, you know, in terms of feedback loops, in terms of conversations, in terms of engagement?
Obviously, that was also another key part of, because just doing internal changes and is not worth it, because then that's no impact on our external world. So we were very keen to also, of course, include the external world into this. And the key part that we did was that we, and that was actually part of an incentive program by then, it's not any longer, but we said, let's really have the ambition in every discussion we have an external partner, ask for feedback every time. And then again, not feedback saying, what do I do good, more or less, what can I improve or what can we improve? Obviously, that was a bit difficult in the beginning for some of our people. But along the way, when they start to say, shit, I get a lot of value out of this. They tell me, you know, how I can improve or even, you know, do things a bit different. We really got the momentum. So we had by then a customer-facing organization, meaning people dedicated to meet customers. That was about 20 people. And in 8 months, I think we collected 6,000 feedbacks. And we took at least 50 or 60 different actions based on those 6,000 feedbacks. And for us, there were small things, there were big things, there were sometimes specifically to that person. Because in the beginning, people were a bit, you know, nervous to see the outcomes and the feedback. But I would say halfway in, the customer facing start to share this, you know, in internal channels, totally vocal, totally happy when they got some really difficult feedback. And maybe that's part of the culture that we created, but I was just amazed to see. And then we built on that. So obviously those discussions turned into actions. And then with actions, we included the external community. So I would say we completely changed how we operate with the external world from being the experts to being the curious people, to asking, saying, you said this, you know, how can we find a solution for that? Yeah. And some to say, yeah, but that's your job to do it. Okay. Thank you for feedback. Then we would do it. In some cases, we find a collaborative spirit. And I would say that how we operate today is that we do as a standard co-creation. I mean, that we, instead of us coming with solutions or saying, this is the product you need for these patients, we are asking about what's your needs, what are the difficulties that you see when you meet your patients. And then we focus our energy on how we can find common ground or commonalities that we can work together. And sometimes our product could be a solution. Sometimes it's not. And that's okay, because we still provide more value to the external world if we work on their problems or sometimes opportunities. Lots of people ask, oh, how about sales then if you don't talk about your products? Yeah, but they know about the products. They know what we represent. They obviously sometimes the products comes into the discussion. So I would say we only see positive upsides on those dialogues. And it has become, you know, a shift from where we are hunting our customers to that they start to call us, saying, I heard this, you know, I have this situation. Could you help us? We have even hospitals in Sweden that open up or set up offices or chairs for our employees. Say, we want you to be here once a month to work with us. This is my group. I like that sounding board. There are some that doesn't trust this at all. I should be honest about that. We come from a pharmaceutical industry is not that well seen. Some beliefs we have a hidden agenda, and I think we are currently talking about that. How do we proceed? But I think my kind of take on was that it would just take a bit more time with them. We need to constantly show that there is no hidden agenda. This is for real. This is how we want to operate going forward. Part of why I'm, you know, doing this exchange is that I like to encourage other pharmaceutical industries or companies to do the same. And I'm really happy now because I talked to a few others in Sweden. They are now changing in exactly the same direction. And I just, you know, encourage that as, you know, as many as can do this, the better it will be. So we have an impact on others to be collaborative, to work together. It's so much more engaging than being this kind of, you know, salesperson that knocks doors and people closes them, you know, in front of you. We see totally different climate out there when we show up like this. And some, again, doesn't trust us, and we need to work on that.
Right. So you've kind of covered the results as we've gone, but I'm going to ask you just to capture them into a short summary of what you've seen as a result of all this magnificent transformation work.
So if I look internally, obviously, we have a much more external focus in everything we do. I think that is a big step in the right direction. Every person or organization today has an external interest of you, some more, some less, but everyone has that. I think also there is still perfection in organization, but in many ways we have removed that. So for example, brand planning, which is like the plan that we, how we want to roll out a product, was usually like a 3 months exercise. Today, it's one slide, which means 10 minutes of work. It was 3 months involving probably 10, 12 people. And today, the empowerment, the accountability lies on one person. Obviously, that's transparent. They share it with others. You know, we save thousands and thousands of hours that we can deliver value for our patients instead. Because a plan is just a plan. It's, you know, it's not worth spending 3 months selling it 5-6 times reviews back, you know, Taylor. How could we do it like that before? I don't, you know, it's so stupid. And today we don't do it. Just the release that this brings to people is just amazing. Obviously, engagement has gone through the roof. We have always been a highly engaged company, but I think the latest engagement survey was, you know, well beyond 95% massively engaged in organization. And tons of others. So that's internal. External world, I think key features that is, we have much more open doors for us. We have signed so many more partnerships than we ever done before. Hospitals, even governments, local governments, I would say, are really keen to work on collaborative and common problems. We never, ever seen that before. This kind of shift of, we are interested about you, what can we start working on together, is really paying off in that way. Obviously, sales of our products is really going well. It can obviously always go better, but I think we really see encouraging happenings there. And another external finding is that people spontaneously call out to be part of organization. And that's other pharma, but it's also a lot of people from healthcare, which shocks us a bit. Even, you know, oncologists, not professor types, but senior oncologists. Wow, this sounds amazing. So you really work to help healthcare become better from your perspective with the resources here? Yeah. Some even want to join us tomorrow and said, I will skip my career as a doctor to join you any day. We haven't actually hired any one of those, but I think I'm sure that will happen because I just see this kind of shift of how we operate as very sustainable and promising. And then there are obviously many others. I think another key feature is that this local initiative is now scaled to be part of a global change for the whole Roche 100,000 employees. I don't think we should take all the credit for that, but our GM is set as a lead for that. Obviously, I'm part of it too. So we are now defining some key guiding principles for the rest of the global organization based on this experiment that we did in Sweden. So we take the credit. It's lovely. Obviously, I think there are similarities that can be used, and there might and probably will be some differences across the world, because China is not Sweden and US is not Sweden either. So there needs to be some tailored approaches, but I'm really, really happy to see how we have tried to deliver and have delivered an experimental prototype that can really make difference.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely inspiring. So we could keep going, because I want you to have conversations about what you measure and metrics and just, you know, how this changed and helped your response with COVID, because that took a lot of companies by surprise. But given the mindset you've got, unlikely that it threw you for a loop as a company, that there would have been just some natural responses. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. There was discussion saying, should we, you know, stop the kind of, you know, journey based on COVID? But people were pressuring us, saying, you know, you started it. You know, we love what you say. This can't be stopped. No, we really want this to happen. People guided us, and then we said, let's continue that. You know, if you want that, let's do it. Otherwise, we could, you know, we could have done it at half speed or whatever. But people were guiding us, and if not one, these were the majority of people said, the ball is rolling. We love this. This is now happening. You know, we've been waiting for this for 20 years. I will be allowed to be my best self. You know, who doesn't want to be that? So please go along. Continue. Yeah.
And what I'm hearing is that people are listening, and that's the difference. My gosh, that's the difference. So the listening and learning combination is extremely powerful in this kind of environment.
I agree. Based on what I said before, this is coming from these informal discussions where we're able to you know, fill in the missing pieces, to be able to close the gaps that people had. If you're planning something like this, really plan to be out there listening, sensing, discussing, being totally honest of, this is an intention, this is what we see, what are you thinking, you know, what input do you have, what can we learn from that? And obviously you can't listen and do what everyone tells you to do, but it gets quite quickly into some kind of patterns. Okay, engagement over here, less engagement over there. Okay, maybe more of this then and a little bit less of that. So I think if I look back, it was probably a bit of luck, but that's how we have operated. That's how I is like a person. I don't believe to stand on the stage to tell people this is how we should do it now. You know, I'm rather having this, you know, let's have a coffee and see what you say.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very, very much for sharing all of that with the audience. And I know people are going to come inspired out of that. Anything you want to add around contact, or can people read up on the transformation? Is it published? What have we got for further resources? I will certainly post the conversation. I need to do a shout out to Matthias Holmgren for plugging us together in the first place, from CRISP in Stockholm. Anything else, though?
There are some articles out there. People can reach out to myself, or I can provide Matthias with that, and he knows about them too. I'm always available if people want to. You know, we are totally vocal. We're totally, you know, open about what we've done and how we did it. Maybe we do it someday to write it up and you know, do it in a, obviously that's tons of presentations, but we haven't done articles. We haven't done that yet. And we are now, you know, learning what we did, and I think these discussions is great for myself. I got, you know, I need to reflect. I need to look back, and someday we will probably write it up, but we haven't done it. I'm totally transparent on that. There are obviously data. I think if you go into the Roche websites and Genentech in the US, there are information available about how we want to operate and how we division and all of that.
I'm certainly grateful for the conversation, because I think it's more real. I mean, what comes across in our conversation that doesn't come across in the article is the passion, the energy, the enthusiasm, the commitment. It's beautiful. And it's just wonderful. So I honestly am quite happy with you continuing to share the way you are. I think it makes such a difference. So thanks again for being with us.
Thank you so much. Love the conversation.
What I think Roche Sweden has done remarkably well is develop that in sensing and intuitive capacity that comes from the internal voice, the whispers on the edge, the opportunity to really hear and feel more deeply what's going on in the organization, and developing far greater capacity than you can ever have when you are working strictly with your mental faculties. So I encourage those of you who are listening to develop those faculties to a greater extent. Obviously, this is an area of strength I have, and I encourage you to contact me and discuss how we can do that in your organization, or if you have a group of people, then we can do something online. But the point is that this is a time more than ever where navigating in ambiguity, navigating in volatile conditions really requires that deeper sense of ability to detect what's going on, preferably before it happens. If not before it happens, then certainly in the moment, because it is really the strength that you have for steering in those uncertain conditions. Thank you for joining me. My name is Donna Jones. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can message me on Twitter at @EPDAWNA_Jones, or reach out to me directly at donna@frominsighttoaction.com. Donna is spelled DAWNA. Or call me 778-230-9326. I'm in Vancouver, Canada, West Coast. If you like this program, I ask you to share it, forward it, put it on social, wherever it is, and continue to support the program. Thank you.